Hi, how are you? So, I was worried about the number of slides I had and whether I'd be able to fit them all in, and then luckily Jez went and said half of it this morning, so that's good. I will be speaking about... No, I won't be speaking about containers. I'll be speaking about enterprises. How many people here are enterprise sysadmins from big, from large companies? How many people here have heard their organization say, we want to be more like Google, we want to do DevOps? And how many people have thought that that was serious? Okay, right. So what I want to do is take some of the themes that Jez spoke about this morning and unpack them a little more and look at what DevOps means at a more, I guess I'll call it a more practical level, so that you can then look at how you might apply those in an enterprise setting and how we can try to smooth that transition. What I've found with enterprises who are now, I'm seeing DevOps dropped into almost every slide pack from vendors as well, and they really don't have a clue what it means, because manually deploying something every 3 weeks is not DevOps. It's not in the same hemisphere as DevOps, but they're going to call that DevOps, because anything vaguely towards continuous integration, continuous delivery, they're going to try to claim, no, we're doing the right thing. Let's look at what it is. And the reason this is an important topic from my perspective is that there's something that has been, to my mind, lost in translation, or lost in emphasis when you look at what DevOps is in an enterprise setting. DevOps seeks to reimagine the enterprise. It is not just about coding. It is actually much wider and deeper than that. Everyone talks about Toyota and Lean and all of those sorts of things. When people say that, they don't really understand what that means for a traditional enterprise that's been going for 30 or 40 years. So what we need to do is spend a few minutes talking about that so that we can understand why there is such pushback against the notion of DevOps and how we might counteract that. When we talk about a factory, we don't talk about this sort of factory. We're talking more about this sort of factory. So think of the bill of materials approach. It's not a one-size-fits-all. It's not just milling machines. It is about designing large, complex systems out of components and assembling those components in the right order. So let's take a look at a couple of these DevOps practices. And the reason I want to talk about behaviors is important, because everyone talks about the DevOps culture. DevOps is first and foremost about culture. But as you heard from Jez this morning, you don't just magically say, here is our culture. You can't decree a culture. You can, on the other hand, decree behaviors. And you can create behaviors that are aligned with creating that new culture, and thus move towards that new culture. So we need to understand some of these behaviors and how they cause a conflict and how we have to deal with this. The first, of course, is this notion of shared ownership and high collaboration versus the current organizational silos. So there's a straight tension there already, of course. How many people are attempting to do DevOps and finding they can't because of the silo problem? Yeah. This is the other one that I find really interesting, is when you talk about DevOps in an enterprise setting, most of the pushback I've seen is because they think, it's just developers wanting to be cowboys and get access to production. It ain't going to happen here. They think about, again, that sort of silo approach. And the way that enterprises manage risk now is they do it through change management. They have these big, ugly snowflake changes. They go through huge amounts of integration testing, and they do them in the dead of night at 2 in the morning in case things go wrong, which they always do, and they spend the next week cleaning them up anyway. So they perceive that is how you manage risk. We'll come back to this theme in a moment, but of course DevOps by no means is about reducing the way you manage risk. It is about managing risk in an entirely different way and a much better way. And the next one, of course, is ephemeral infrastructure. How many people in an enterprise build machines and then manually enter stuff in the CMDB to say, here's the machine, its IP address, its host name, here's the details about who owns it and all the rest of it? Though this is one of the recurring themes that we're going to come back to, that in an enterprise setting, there is an assumption that you sort of build infrastructure once and leave it alone for 5 years. Because, of course, we used to buy these huge million-dollar pieces of equipment, and we'd spend months commissioning them, and then we'd leave them the hell alone. And the enterprise processes are set up that way. So when you say, oh, no, we're going to build this, and when we put the next version up in production, we're actually going to build it on entirely new servers and then swap across to those servers, that's not something that enterprises have had to deal with. And so they're used to these handcrafted snowflakes. And, of course, automation is very, very important versus the continual manual fulfillment. The common thing with large enterprises is, of course, they're highly outsourced and they keep tweaking the number down on how much they're paying. So, no, we've got to do more cost savings on this, which, of course, also drives the quality of the people down as well because they're looking for the cheapest possible implementation cost. And to do that, they are heavily reliant on well-defined procedures and they still do manual fulfillment on everything instead of automation. And lastly, feedback loops. Of course, DevOps is very, very big on real feedback loops. One of the problems with the enterprise that I'm working in at the moment is you build your system, and during that build, you engage the alarm team to design and build all of the standard alarms, and they're all commissioned. So all this stuff is set during the CapEx build phase of the project before you've had any production time to actually know what's going to go wrong. And so you've set up all of your alarm profiles, and now you can't adjust them because that requires more CapEx and a re-engagement, but you don't have that once the project's over. You only have OpEx. How many people are in that situation? Okay, I get it bad. So that's one of the things that happens as you move to the cloud, the move from CapEx to OpEx. So of course, we've all seen slides like this. DevOps does risk management differently. It is not that it doesn't do risk management, it is that it takes a different approach. One of the things that is so important to understand why the threat model here, is that, where was I going with that? I just lost my brain for a moment. Deployment is everything in DevOps. You build the release pipeline, you take the same approach to build from source artifacts all the way through, so you will have promoted something three or four times by the time it gets to production. So you've eliminated the risk. If you think about what change management is about two things. It is about ensuring the correctness of the new target state, and it is about ensuring the correctness of the process by which you get to that target state. Well, of course, if we've already built exactly the same thing as production several times, we've hit those risks head on. So it's not that we're not doing risk management, so we're doing it much smarter. And of course, deployment is decoupled from activation in DevOps. Again, this is the thing, that if you are doing an all or nothing change at 2 in the morning, then if the change works, it affects 100% of the user base. If the change doesn't work, it affects 100% of the user base. The DevOps approach is you decouple activation from deployment so that you deploy whenever you like, but then you only turn it on for 1% of the people, and even if it's a really bad bug, only a small number of people have been affected. So again, when you think about what risk is in terms of likelihood and impact, we're directly addressing the impact a different way. And this is where you need to go back to the basics. I've been in meetings where these vendors try to say, oh yeah, well, we just want to push code out, and they don't think about these are production systems and you've got people who are used to a particular threat model, and you need to explain that this is actually improvement over that threat model. And of course, deployment is by no means one size fits all. It's not done through Word documents. It's done through a rail yard approach of bill of materials of assembling the pieces. Another big thing with DevOps is the ephemeral infrastructure thing. Cattle not pets, of course. So this is what I was saying, a huge problem for enterprises whose processes are designed around building something once. And now, they expect these things to be commissioned and decommissioned by very heavy processes. If you can burn them away with an API, that's a very different model that these operations teams are used to. So that's a source of angst. Released through parallel infrastructure. This is even more threatening because, as I said, we might have entirely new virtual infrastructure for each production release. And that's they're used to having a server name that's the same. They're used to knowing exactly how to find things because they haven't stayed in the same place for 2 years. And all of their processes are built around that assumption. And of course, transient infrastructure. They're also used to that with all of the test environments on the way and all of those other things. So the whole idea here is that we are completely changing the model in which infrastructure is stood up, used, and decommissioned. This is a huge threat in an enterprise setting. All of their processes over decades have gone a different way. And of course, automate everything. I won't go into that one. But DevOps does a whole bunch of these things. It looks at quality all the way along. It looks at quality in terms of minimum viable product, minimum marketable features. It looks at it in terms of just-in-time infrastructure, continuous integration, continuous delivery, feature flags, A/B testing, all this stuff. You know, so this is all about using the release pipeline, and just as Jess said this morning, everyone owns quality. Everyone owns the pipeline. Everyone works on the pipeline together. And that is the DevOps way. Enterprise IT, on the other hand, is, shall we say, somewhat different. From an operations perspective, we have developers throwing dead cats over the fence all the time. We have manually implemented changes, lack of backup plans, lack of testing. I've seen these things where people are going, no, we ran out of time, so we didn't do all the tests. We just need to get into production now. What about your backups? Oh, yeah, we didn't have time to do that. Okay, so you want me to put this into production when you haven't done any of the background work? This is normal in an enterprise setting. And, of course, the environments are all different. Production is always different from everything that's before it. So that's what they're used to. And if that is what they're used to, then, of course, that threat model means you have, you know, Papa Bear shouting at you, have you got your change ready? Have you got two backups in the can? Have you done your homework? And that's the CAB model of threat management. Of course, it's not just the devs that get it wrong. The sysadmins have problems as well. All or nothing changes. Change windows in the dead of night. Well, of course, sorry. You haven't seen that before. There you go. While that slides up, I'll talk to the other stuff. So the whole idea of all or nothing changes, the whole idea of change windows in the dead of night implemented by these people who are the furthest away from the application. So they have the least knowledge about the application, the ones that are actually implementing the change. And the information transfer has been in the form of a Word document. How many people is that what the scenario that they're used to? I'll have to move on. So the result of this is that everyone's the enemy. The code quality that's being punted through in enterprise settings is crap. It's Java written by people who've had 6 weeks of Java training. The handoff is all siloed, and because of those silos, no one actually really cares whether it's going to work or not. They just care about CYA, which is, again, one of the comments that Jez made earlier. The contracts require continual cost reductions. That's a database problem. We'll flip it over the fence to the database team. Oh, wait, they need access to system log files. Back comes the ticket. It takes days to deal with failures instead of minutes. And that's why you see these results in the DevOps survey, 168 times improvement of mean time to repair. Staggering results. And, of course, the reason is because it's all about process over people, whereas DevOps goes exactly the opposite way. It is about trust adults to deliver. So we end up with these sorts of conflicts. Manual configuration changes versus automated deployment. Application architectures defined by network design. Well, of course, with clouds, that's flipped too. The network design is now defined by the application architecture instead. Bespoke infrastructure versus ephemeral infrastructure. Risk managed through change windows versus progressive activation. And again, the key one, this last one, is a theme we're coming back to, that all of the processes are biased towards the first time build, whereas DevOps is all about continual build. So that actually leads right into what is the root cause of this problem. with enterprise adoption. And it is exactly that, that enterprises are built, not just in IT, but the whole enterprise is built around end-to-end processes that see new as complex, high-risk, expensive, and time-consuming. Let's talk about that a bit more. When you are in an enterprise, and as exactly what Jez was saying this morning, you have a new idea, you put a business case together, the first thing that happens is you get into some form of constructors forum where all the different department heads go, well, this is what it's going to mean for me, this is what it's going to mean for me, here's how much money I need from you and how much time, and then they all go off and do their thing and they come back a year or two later and deliver something that wasn't what everyone wanted. And that's the process. So that's waterfall all the way from the beginning, long before it gets to IT. And so, of course, that's why they have these huge PMOs, project management offices, and 3 to 6 project managers to every technical person, and that sort of thing. It's because that's their model. That's their mental model on how they're doing this. Of course, DevOps is about a continual series of small changes, but there's also a limit to what DevOps can do in that enterprise setting, because you've got, in an enterprise, you typically have channels, you'll have customers. You can't go changing the product every day. You know, then you might be able to do lots of changes every day, but some of those need a quarterly release where you get to retrain the channel. You need to retrain your staff. You need to go through compliance. You need to do these other big ticket items. So DevOps doesn't solve everything. That's part of the thing here. How many people know ITIL? How many people have seen that diagram? That's the typical diagram of ITIL. That is, again, look, you want to look at it and you know it's waterfall. Service strategy then begets a service design. The service design creates an SDP, a service definition package, which is handed across to service transition. Interestingly, service transition is where they actually build the thing and transition it. Although if you go looking around to work out where is this thing actually built, it turns out service transition is where it has to be built, but it's not actually discussed in service transition at all in the ITIL documents. It just magically appears. And then service operation. Well, guess what? There's another view of ITIL. This is also a view of the same things. So ITIL doesn't have to be waterfall the same way that SDLC didn't have to be waterfall. We introduced agile practices into software development. We can do the same thing for the ITIL side of the house, for the ops side of the house, by taking that more incremental view of these operations practices. And I'm not the first person to be saying this. This is off an old DevOps site. Someone else was saying the same thing a few years back. So it's, again, moving from do something once to just-in-time infrastructure. That said, there are two problems with ITIL. It assumes manual execution, and it assumes the waterfall design implementation project. So they're the assumptions that you have to get around and re-engineer in your existing processes. Now, how many people have heard of ISO 9001? What is it? See, you know the name, don't know what it is. It's the International Standard for Quality. Boiled down, it says two things. That there is a defined process for all of the things you do, and there are records to show that you followed them. In other words, this is about consistency of quality. And the intention is that once you've got that that consistency of quality, you then work on the process to improve the quality to where you want it to be. So once you do, what you do is effectively you get an ISO 9000 cert, that establishes a baseline, and then you can ratchet up the process from there to improve the quality. That's the intention. That's what ISO 9000 is meant to be. How many people have seen those processes ever change in their organization? That's the problem. The problem is that these things get set in stone. Oh, we don't want to put our ISO 9000 certification at risk. We can't do that. So these processes get locked in stone instead of being seen as the means to improving quality. So when I say we need to re-engineer these processes, I'm not saying that's an easy thing to do, because you have to be able to educate people that you can still maintain your ISO 9000 compliance while doing this. As I said earlier, DevOps is not a one-size-fits-all. It doesn't solve everything. There are certain things that require much larger cycles. So, for example, you might have marketing releases every 3 months or so where you do the work that goes into those, and then you've got the product development would be happening across multiple cycles, but of course DevOps delivery can still do things like bug releases and customer-specific features and things like that very, very rapidly. So the engineering practice underneath can be DevOps. which is what it says there. So what does this mean? What does DevOps mean for the organization? Is operations going to still exist? These are the sort of questions you hear thrown about. This is what a traditional organization typically looks like. If you're in a telco, then you've got a separate network group, which repeats it all again. But otherwise, you've got different silos. How many people, that's what your work looks like? Okay. What I'm starting to see, and again, Jez stole my thunder, he was talking about bimodal IT and how much he doesn't like it. One of the things that we're seeing is this schizophrenic organization starting to appear. As people want to be DevOps over here, but not over there. We're seeing this thing, and they're coming up with names. Oh, we'll call this the RunOps group, and we'll do DevOps in that. And so some of the systems are starting to move towards being DevOps. And I'll come back to this notion of CloudOps in a moment. And the other groups are all left behind looking after the legacy stuff. That seems to be where we are at the moment. But that, of course, is not the end game. The end game is something a bit more like this, a bit more Google-like, a bit more unicorn-like, where you have a development operations team, you have the DevOps teams, which I'm going to talk about in a moment, you have CloudOps and SRE. They are the sort of the key functions that I think we're going to eventually move to over the coming 5 to 10 years in most organizations. Which means, interestingly, I actually see DevOps as an evolution of the development role, and I see SysOps evolving into SRE and CloudOps. CloudOps being a role that will be diminishing over time. And we'll talk about, again, what that means. Everyone talks about culture, so here's your ubiquitous culture slide. Obviously, you want to do KPI alignment. In an enterprise setting, it's really important to make sure that your devs and your ops share KPIs. That's one way to help start bringing this together. Co-location, co-owned, and supported services. Again, I can only repeat what Jez said this morning. Moving towards a product view is really important here. And these are steps that I'll come back to because we can take these steps now. What does it mean for process? Well, as I said, we've got to change ITIL or ETOM or whatever process framework you're using. And there are those things that are inherently human-led, like those sorts of design steps. Well, they're going to be less affected. But as you move closer to the keyboard, then those processes become much more affected. So change management, configuration management, they must be heavily fixed. They must be changed to support this continual delivery world. Please get rid of Word and Excel. It's just my personal mission is to try to kill it as an artifact. So of course, we talked about servers becoming cattle, not pets. That's the standard DevOps line. The other thing though is that the OSS systems, the operational support systems, have to become API driven. Where I am, as I said, the large telco, you engage the monitoring team through funding pools during project build to get all of the statically defined alarming built. Well, that's not going to fly if you're changing servers all the time. When you onboard into the CMDB, the same thing. If you want to know where the service is running and that's changing on almost a minute-by-minute basis or at least a week-by-week basis, then those manual processes are just not going to keep up. And so what happens is the ops teams evolve. So I've mentioned this a couple of times, CloudOps and DevOps. What I see happening in an enterprise setting is, again, one of the things that was discussed this morning, that the DevOps is really that front-of-house function where operations teams go and embed within developers. And so you might run a DevOps team the same way you run a PMO, a project management organization, where you have a central pool of these infrastructure people who go out and sit in the projects but are still part of the operations structure. So they help service the needs because, if you think about a nice agile project, we've got 2-week iteration cycle and this week we need a new database server, done. This week we need to add new 2 developers to the project, done. You need, obviously, all of that operations involvement, but those operations people can be acting as a bridge into the enterprise organization and helping keep the application team as DevOps as it can be. So I think that, you know, one of the things I think we're going to see is that happening on the front of house. But then we've got all of the back of house stuff. We've got all of those resource pools, all of those, you know, machines that are not going away anytime soon. And the trick there is to start to think of them as resource pools. Stop thinking of them as, you know, snowflakes. And so that means taking the view of internal infrastructure as a cloud. Even if it isn't technically a cloud, moving towards that view so that you can, because ultimately if you've got a cloud, what you have is a bunch of independent tenancies that self-service. And that's a key thing. That I don't want to have, you know, if I'm a development team, I need to be able to do my work without having to, you know, lodge work tickets and wait. I need to be able to self-service within the container that I have control of, which is my project. And so to do that, as the platform provider, I need to take that platform view and create something that is biased or, you know, it creates those tenancies within a platform. And a good way to think about this is CRUD. Create, read, update, delete is the standard model that is used to define these things. When you talk about REST APIs, they follow the CRUD model as well. What it means is that moving in a world, how many people here are in an enterprise where it basically never decommissions anything? Man, okay. I expected more hands. I know that, you know, we've got 27, 28, 30,000 machines, all nice and bespoke and very high administrator to machine ratios because they're all bespoke and nothing ever gets turned off. And, oh, we're going to build these new systems and get rid of all the old ones. Well, we build the new systems and never turn off the old ones. So one of the things is to make sure that for every create, there's a delete. So if you can ask for a VM, you must be able to get rid of the VM. If you can ask for a storage line, you must be able to get rid of it. And then the other thing is to move away from the create bias to the consume and adjust bias, to the penalty-free adjust bias. And that's what this 1 to 20 thing is. You know, for every VM I create, I might want to be able to snapshot it and get a list of the snapshots and restore a snapshot and shut it down. And there are, you know, 20, 30, 50 lifecycle functions that I want to be able to do once I've created it. And so this, when you create a service catalog, and you think in your service catalog, you think along these lines. And if you're doing that, even for your internal resource pools, when you're moving towards everything as a service and that product view, that means that you've taken this huge step towards supporting DevOps activities in your enterprise. And of course, this is really important for the other part of the back of house is, well, if you go take a cloud view, you got to remember that change windows are just something that's from old school. You know, there is no such thing as maintenance window on the internet, only downtime. So you need to make sure that, you know, you can do the maintenance of those resource pools without taking without use of visible downtime. Now, you may not be able to do that all the time. And again, there are different categories of infrastructure. I mean, one of the reasons that we have built over the years all of this highly redundant infrastructure, redundant at every single layer with mirror disks and power supplies and network paths, the reason we did that is because these monolithic vertical applications suck at failure. They do not cope with failure well. So we've had to compensate all the way down. And of course, DevOps is a model that says, well, no, the underlying infrastructure is unreliable. Now write your code to deal with that. So what's happened as part of this transition is we can now provide infrastructure much more cheaply, but we declare it to be unreliable, the same way that UDP is technically unreliable. You know, it's there in a technical sense that you must be able to deal with the fact that something went wrong. And so if we deal with our infrastructure the same way, we can say these are reliable resource pools and these are unreliable resource pools. And we can help encouraging people towards cloud-native applications. So, how are we doing? How do we get there? Okay, so I've spoken about the process level and the practical level. I think what I want to do to finish up is talk about the organizational level and some of the issues that come up there. And here, this is where we'll talk about some patterns. There's some anti-patterns and some patterns. The anti-pattern that I want to talk about is softly. This one is how to basically undermine the move towards DevOps. If you see, you know, this sort of approach or things tending towards this approach, then you know what's going on. Basically, you know, the innate corporate resistance can continue for years with this sort of model. They can continue to make these micro adjustments that make it look like they're supporting the initiative publicly, but of course not actually making any real progress towards it. Vendor incentives remain unchanged, and of course the behaviour doesn't change. And you can build buffers, all of those normal things. So this is best explained by a guy who was around some time back called Machiavelli. There's a book called The Prince, which I recommend reading, along with Sun Tzu's Art of War. I'll read this out. There is nothing more difficult to take in hand, more perilous to conduct, or more uncertain in its success, and more dangerous to carry through than to take the lead in the introduction of a new order of things. For the reformer has enemies in all of those who profit by the old order, and only lukewarm defenders in all of those who would profit under the new order. This lukewarmness, arising part from a fear of their adversaries, and partly from the incredulity of mankind, who do not truly believe in anything until they have actually experienced it. So, to paraphrase, you don't just take the horse to water, you hold its head under a couple of gulps. But this is it. Is, you know, what that tells you is that you've got a bunch of people with existing power struggles. They have a power structures, and they are going to resist the move to something that they feel threatens their power structure. So softly hands all of the power to the wrong people. That's why it's the ultimate anti-pattern. Similar is the pilot project. That's the let's dip our toe in the water. It can be a good proving ground to help shake some of these things out, but it sort of tells people you aren't convinced. It's like, yeah, I can see all that evidence, but I'm not sure that'll work here. And it can devolve into softly. Outside in, well, if you remember Linux servers, oh, we're going to run all of our core on Solaris. You can do your web servers on Linux, but we're going to keep the core as Solaris. And so Linux took years to slowly move in towards the core. And that's another approach, is that, you know, well, you know, what I'm seeing is, oh, you can do DevOps on that sort of those website-y things, but no, our CRM system, we're going to keep that all old school. How many people have seen that approach happen? Okay. And again, you know, it still means you're getting it in there. It means you're starting to prove it out. You're starting to change the culture in certain areas, and then you know, let it ripple from there. But of course, the benefits are ultimately limited because those internal systems, you still have to deal with them somehow, and it can take a long time if you just let it run its course. Which leads us to the one that was being discussed this morning, bimodal IT. So they talk about bimodal IT, and in fact, this is what bimodal IT is as defined by Gartner. You have mode one, which is the reliable inner systems where it takes months in the cycle time, versus mode two, which is the agility and you know those sort of faster moving systems with very short cycle times and the like. This is the Gartner view. I read that, and what I see is let the old systems wither and die, and let's just let the cool kids work on the new stuff. That's the way I interpret that one. It's a sort of a, we're going to throw our hands up in the air. We don't believe we can actually change the organization, so we're going to create a new one. And that's, you know, what some of the things that Jez was saying this morning. So let's look at some positive patterns. So, of course, one of the big ones is top-down, is choose, have the management say, no, we know this works, let's go. Choose something high-profile, and high value, and prove it. Put your best people on it, a tiger team with the best people. That means you will hit every one of the issues head on, and you will deal with them with the best people head on. And of course, you need to challenge everything. You will find, certainly in large enterprise settings, that means usually going to better vendors, to the smaller, more agile, and DevOps-friendly vendors, newer technologies, things like PaaS. So moving away from, here, give me five virtual machines to here, give me five slots in a PaaS. And of course the changes to the operate model, all that stuff of using SaaS-based monitoring, all these things that may be highly unconventional for the organization thus far, and build the new world out that way, prove it out. Do it very publicly. Another way is be more like the unicorns, which is put everything you can on the cloud. Use SaaS services to the extent you can. APIs everywhere. Innovation layers. And basically reduce the surface area of the incumbent systems. That looks a bit like this. What you can do is you take these core systems, the stable core, you put, you might have an enterprise management system in, a messaging system in there, some APIs, top and bottom, and then you can innovate around them. So that's, again, the model that was brought up this morning of the strangler pattern. So this is actually enables the strangler pattern, but also it stretches out into cloud-hosted solutions by creating some integration zones where things can land if they're out on the web. And so this allows you to have a conversation with security and create defined integration zones and contain the landing of certain services. It allows you to actually implement DevOps where you can. And ultimately, that begets multimodal IT, which is this notion that there are multiple speeds and the API effectively acts as the clutch between those speeds. And so this is one of the diagrams I've seen used a few times where you have the systems of record, which are highly governed and slow to change, versus the systems of innovation, which are high changing and fast to change. A couple of other patterns just to wrap things up. The freeway is always a good one. Basically, there are people in your organization who are doing DevOps now. And so, let them. Help them. Do this with, find them, advertise what they've done, build on it. Build on ramps to help other people be like that team. That's another approach you can take. And then the other one was one I mentioned earlier, which is the platform bridge. So if you understand that the old world isn't going away anytime soon, what you try to do is you try to create a bridge between that world and the new world. So for example, I've just built an API gateway. Now, if you look at that in its whole, 95-99% of the changes are going to be pushing out new APIs. So I want that to happen, continuous delivery. So what I did is I created a platform which has a tenancy model. So we have tenancy management processes, we have the platform. The platform is subject to normal change control, optimized, because we know what we're doing. But then the tenancies get to actually use CI/CD to actually push their stuff through all the way to production, or just before production, so we haven't been able to negotiate that last button press, and now Ops still has to press that button for us on Jenkins. But there's no Word documents, the change plans are all online, and it's a button press. So taking this sort of model allows you to, by isolating tenants that are self-service, most things can happen, because the same way, if you're using a computer system, well, that doesn't require change management, you're just using the system. And so by establishing a platform, they're just using the system. They're just using the platform. So they're not subject to IT change controls, assuming you line your ducks up properly. And so that's another approach that can come with that. Just to finish up, what can I do? Well, embrace the release pipeline is the bottom line. That is at the core of everything DevOps. It is about continuous quality. It is about shared ownership. It is about all of those things that Jez spoke about this morning. Everything from source, automated testing, infrastructure as code, automated release, all of that stuff. And set the groundwork up. So if you have manual change management systems, get APIs in front of them. If you have manual CMDBs, get APIs in front of them. If you have manual monitoring and alarming systems, get APIs in front of them. Help get your underlying systems DevOps friendly. And then, I guess the last thing is the journey of 1,000 steps starts with the first step. Thank you.
I am part of the team that runs the control systems.
Sorry, could you speak up a bit, please?
Sorry. I'm part of the team that runs the control systems for a particle accelerator, amongst other things. And I've heard a couple of people tell me that DevOps isn't really suitable for safety-critical applications.
Yeah, that's rubbish.
We're pretty safety-critical in what we do.
So,
have you got any tips?
So, see that shows a fundamental misunderstanding of what DevOps is. And that's, again, some of the things that Jez was saying this morning. That in fact, you see quality go up, not the other way around. You see, mean time to repair drop through the floor. These are all proven results. But because, you're not skimping on quality, you're building it right in. You're doing everything you can to, the automated testing, hundreds of thousands of tests. Every time something slips through the cracks, you go, right, we have some more tests to write, and that never happens again. So your quality asymptotes towards zero bugs. You'll never get there, but that's why it's asymptoting. But it absolutely, DevOps will help you in those environments because smaller changes mean more provable, more testable, more everything, which means that you're not doing this amorphous blob, which you're not quite sure if you really got it right. So inherently, it is safer to do the DevOps approach.